equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Etnair, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. Got a great show coming up today. As the final week of the long-awaited Copenhagen climate talks begin, we're going to review what's at stake, what's happened so far, what to watch out for, and why it matters. Vermont Law School professor Pat Parento is a guest for the whole hour. Parento is a former director of Vermont Law School's Environmental Law Center and of the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Clinic there. He also has a long background in Washington, D.C. He was holding three positions with the National Wildlife Federation in D.C. in the 70s and 80s. And then later on, during the Reagan administration, he served as regional counsel for the U.S. EPA Region 1 in Boston. He came to Vermont in 1987 to serve as commissioner of the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation, and he returned to Vermont in 93 when he assumed the directorship of the Environmental Law Center. He also teaches at Dartmouth College now as an adjunct professor in environmental studies. Pat Parento, welcome to Equal Time.
Thank you, Carl. Good to be here.
I've seen you at a number of conferences in the last month talking about climate change and why it matters. So you do such a good job of articulating that. Why don't we begin today's talk all about Copenhagen with telling us what's at stake here?
Well, nothing short of the future of humanity on a livable planet is what's at stake. Whether Copenhagen will result in a binding treaty that addresses that crisis is certainly an open question, but Copenhagen represents one of our last best chances to make meaningful progress towards a global treaty. This is a problem that can only be solved by all the nations of the world, both developed and developing. And they're there in Copenhagen, and it's the usual hurly-burly of an international negotiation session like this with plenty of posturing and street theater and demands and counter demands, and I think things are finally coming to a head here towards the end of the week, though, so it'll be very interesting to see what accomplishes there.
Now, my understanding is that the talks in Copenhagen going on right now are part of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and that similar talks have been taking place every year for quite a while. What's special about this year's talks?
This is the official meeting of the parties, the so-called COP 15, which means it's the 15th official or formal meeting of the parties to the Framework Convention. You're correct. This is all done under the auspices of the Framework Agreement, which has been signed by 190 countries, including the United States. We are a signatory to the Framework Convention. That was done under George H.W. Bush Sr.'s administration. We're not, of course, a signatory to the Kyoto Protocol under the Framework Agreement, but we're parties to the basic agreement that pledges the nations of the world to avoid what is called dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. And you're right that these meetings occur all the time with various representatives of the parties, but this is the only time that the actual heads of state will be sitting down around various negotiating tables towards the end of this week to try and hammer out an agreement. So that's what distinguishes it.
And this has been played as a sort of a successor, or is it building on the Kyoto Protocol, which expires, or at least is originally written to go to 2012? Can you explain the interaction between these talks and the Kyoto Protocol?
That's correct. One of the questions is whether to extend the Kyoto Protocol beyond what's called the first commitment period, which expires in 2012. That's a period of time that references the commitments of the signatories to the Kyoto Protocol, which are essentially the developed nations, the so-called Annex I nations of the world, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So one issue on the table is, should the Kyoto Protocol, that framework which distinguishes between the developed world and the developing world, the two-track approach, in other words, should that continue beyond 2012, or should Kyoto be replaced with a new single-track integrated treaty, which is the preferred option of the United States, seeking to have a treaty that binds both the developed countries and the developing countries. That would be, in essence, a new protocol. It would be under the Framework Convention, but it would be a new agreement and a different framework. So that's probably the crux of the debate that's going on in Copenhagen. Are we going to stick with the two-track formula of Kyoto, or are we going to change to the single-track integrated treaty that the United States wants?
And is that something that people saw as the crux of the matters in the Copenhagen negotiations well ahead of time, or did that decision whether to go with extending Kyoto or to go with a single-track agreement, did that pop up during the negotiations last week?
The issue of should there be this single integrated treaty was discussed in several of the meetings even before Copenhagen, in Bali, in Poznan, in Bonn. There were several meetings, and there was never any consensus among the representatives of the parties that were meeting in those meetings on should they adopt a single document or dual document. So it came into Copenhagen without any firm resolution of that question, and so they just deferred it to the Copenhagen meeting, and that means it won't get settled. If it gets settled at all, it will only get settled right at the end of the week, in the last probably 24 hours of negotiations. And I don't think anybody can really predict what the outcome might be.
Mm. Well, just remind us, the Kyoto Protocol, it was negotiated, I believe, in 1998. And what does it do, and who's ratified it?
It does several things. It does set targets and timetables for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and the average was supposed to be a reduction of 5% measured by 1990 baseline emission levels, and that was supposed to have been accomplished by 2012 in the so-called first commitment period. That isn't going to happen. Most of the signatories to the Kyoto Protocol are not going to meet. Not only are they not going to meet their reductions, they're actually going to have increases, net increases, in their emissions from 1990 levels. In addition to that, everybody knows that those levels of reductions are nowhere near what the science is saying is required to stabilize the climate and prevent some of the worst consequences. So in some respects, you might regard Kyoto as a dead letter. It can't be what comes from either Copenhagen, or if we can't get a final agreement in Copenhagen, what might occur in the next scheduled meeting, which is in Mexico City in the end of 2010. The levels of reduction are going to have to be much higher. The commitment from both developed and developing nations is going to have to be much greater. The financing for all of this to occur, which wasn't resolved in the Kyoto Protocol, that is another huge sticking point. Who's going to finance both the mitigation measures and the adaptation measures in the poorest nations of the world? That's got to get worked out. So I think what we're talking about is a new global agreement. Whether it's dual track, single track, is probably in the end less important than how quickly and by how much can we begin pulling these greenhouse gas reductions down to the levels that we need to get them.
And who's ratified the Kyoto Protocol?
There are, I believe, 110 nations that have ratified it. The last nation that was required to ratify it for it to go into effect was Russia, and that's what made it finally a binding treaty. And again, it doesn't have any of the developing world, even, I mean, the China, India, Brazil, South Africa, a lot of these nations that are fast, some of which are fast developing, of course, they were not signatories.
They were not signatories because it had no impact on them, correct?
That's correct. It had no obligations, and so they sat it out.
And so is the U.S. the only industrialized country that has the option of being a signatory that would be affected by the Kyoto Protocol that hasn't ratified it at this point?
Yes. The United States is the only industrialized nation that has refused to ratify. Australia was at one time, but with the change in their prime minister to Mr. Rudd, Australia did ratify Kyoto, so that left the United States alone among the major industrialized nations as not being a signatory to Kyoto.
Well, if the effect of Kyoto has been, well, you haven't said it's negligible, but you have said that that the signatory countries have not reduced their CO2, their greenhouse gas emissions, as much as they said they would, and most have had increases. Why could we expect anything better out of Copenhagen?
Well, we have to expect, I think probably the word that we have to use is we have to hope that there is a breakthrough in Copenhagen on this divide between the developed and the developing countries. There has been some positive signs. That's the only way you can probably describe it. China and India, for the first time in the recent months, have both committed to reducing the rate of growth of their emissions. Now, that's obviously not the same thing as making a commitment to absolute reductions, which is what the United States is demanding. But it has to be taken as a very strong sign that those nations recognize that their own self-interests are hugely at stake. Some of the worst consequences of climate change for agricultural productivity, for sea level rise and flooding of coastal areas, for drought conditions, for human health and safety concerns are actually going to be hitting Asia, and specifically China and India, harder than they're going to be hitting the United States and some of the other wealthier countries who are better prepared to adapt to at least the early stages of climate change consequences. I mean, you can get to, if we really don't get serious about these reductions, we are all going to get to a point where adaptation just is not even possible for the kinds of consequences. But in the early years of the next couple of decades, China and India recognize that they've got a serious human crisis on their hands. They've got huge populations that are continuing to increase. They've got food shortages that they're predicting. So they're starting to get more serious about commitments to reduce, but they're not at the place that they need to be.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Pat Parento. He's a professor at Vermont Law School, about what's happening in Copenhagen last week and this week. We'll continue the discussion right after this. Welcome back to Equal Time Radio here on WDEV. I'm Carl Ettmeyer. We also have a website, equaltimeradio.com, where you can download podcasts of previous shows and get some announcements about what's coming up in future shows and find relevant links to things that are mentioned on our shows. Now, my theme when I'm in here on Mondays is usually food, energy, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. But today we're talking about the International Conference on Climate Change in Copenhagen, just because that is so connected with energy production, and global issues like climate change are possible to do something about on the local level, obviously, but they cannot be tackled by the world unless the world nations get together in a place like Copenhagen, Mexico City next year, Bali a couple of years ago, get together and make binding agreements. We're privileged to have Pat Parento. He is a Vermont Law School professor and expert on climate change talks with us here on the line. Pat Parento, could you explain the connection between what's happening in Washington, D.C. right now, as there's a climate bill that's gone through the House, past the House of Representatives. It's in the Senate right now. What's the connection between that dynamic and what's happening in Copenhagen this week, particularly with Barack Obama going over as one of the heads of state later on this week to represent the United States?
Yes, there is a very definite connection. President Obama announced, I think about a week ago or within the last couple of weeks for sure, that he was coming to Copenhagen. Originally he was going to come when he picked up his Nobel Peace Prize. Now he said he's going to come on the 18th, the end of the week, which is when all the other heads of state are going to be there. And that was a clear signal that he meant to roll up his sleeves and get involved in trying to negotiate an agreement. Plus, he said that the United States would commit to a 17% reduction in its greenhouse gas emissions as measured from the 2005 baseline, which is different, actually, than the 1990 baseline used in Kyoto. But nevertheless, it's widely regarded as a significant commitment by the United States to reducing greenhouse gases. And it was a risky move for the president because he does not have 60 votes right now in the Senate to commit to that level of reduction. The 17% figure comes from, as you mentioned, the House-passed bill, which is the Waxman-Markey bill. So the president did have at least one House of Congress committing to that level of reduction, but he does not have that same level of commitment on the Senate side, and it's actually not clear that he can get the 60 votes in the Senate for that. So he's taking a gamble by going to Copenhagen and pledging on his word that the United States will be able to deliver on that. And you may recall, and your listeners may recall, a similar situation happened with Kyoto. When Al Gore, who was then vice president, went to Kyoto and made some strong commitments on behalf of the United States, only to find and signed, actually Bill Clinton as president, signed the Kyoto Protocol, only to find that they couldn't get it ratified. And in fact, they never presented it to the Senate for ratification because they didn't have the votes then for reduction. So this is all very interesting and all very hard to follow, all these different moves that people are making. But I do see it as a very significant step that Obama must believe that he can get pretty darn close to the votes he needs in the Senate to back up whatever pledge he makes in Copenhagen. Otherwise, he's really sort of risking the credibility of his office, both abroad and at home. So that was a significant development.
So last week, the Environmental Protection Agency issued a statement about greenhouse gases and how they threaten the welfare of humans. Does that strengthen Barack Obama's hand going into Copenhagen?
Yes. You're talking about the latest science developments?
No, under the Clean Air Act that...
I'm sorry. The Environmental Protection Agency, this was not unexpected, but the timing was obviously quite interesting. Lisa Jackson, who is the EPA administrator, announced that EPA was finalizing its so-called endangerment finding under the Clean Air Act. This is the finding that was at issue in the case that went to the United States Supreme Court that's known as Massachusetts versus EPA. This was litigated in the Bush administration when the Bush administration refused basically to use the Clean Air Act to address climate change, and a group of states led by Massachusetts sued and got the Supreme Court to order EPA to consider using the Clean Air Act to address climate change. And the statute requires that the EPA make this finding that greenhouse gases actually threaten public health and welfare, and that's what's known as the endangerment finding. The Obama administration proposed an endangerment finding as one of the first things they did when they took office back in February of 2009. And last week, on the first day, I think it was, of the Copenhagen conference, EPA, Lisa Jackson announced that they were now making that endangerment finding final. That sets up the opportunity for Obama and EPA to use existing authority under the Clean Air Act to address greenhouse gases. And by some analysts, you could actually get to address 80 to 90% of the sources of greenhouse gases in the United States using existing authority without even needing a new climate bill. Of course, opponents, which include the coal industry in particular, are very concerned about the costs, obviously, of using the existing regulatory structure of the Clean Air Act as opposed to a new climate bill, which would have more features built into it to control costs, to allow companies to cap and trade their emissions, to use offsets to satisfy some of the emission reductions. So the EPA has been using the Clean Air Act, if you will, as a club to kind of say to Congress and to the industry, either you agree on a new climate bill or we'll use the authority we have and force the reductions that way. And in Copenhagen, that gave further credibility to Obama's pledge that he was serious about making reductions in greenhouse gases and that he would use the authority that he already has to do it if he couldn't get Congress to go along with him. So another very interesting move by our president to try to convince the other nations of the world that the United States is determined to become part of the solution and no longer part of the problem here.
Let me make sure I understand what you just said about the existing regulatory structure, Pat Parento. You used the figure 80 to 90% of existing greenhouse gas emissions could be regulated by it. Does that mean that if you add up all the greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., then 80 to 90% of them are subject to EPA regulation now?
That's correct.
Okay, so this 17% reduction from 2005, Obama, with this regulatory authority, could potentially go beyond that.
That's correct. Now, it's probably not true that under any conceivable set of regulations, EPA would get to an 80 to 90% reduction, but it is certainly plausible that EPA could get beyond the 17% reduction. And, you know, just to kind of perhaps make an advocacy point here, the fact is that the regulatory structure that currently exists is there to do this. When you start talking about a new climate change program, which is of the type passed by the House, that's all very new and complicated. That's an economy-wide cap-and-trade program. So one of the concerns that some people have is that even if you get a bill passed by the Senate and you reconcile the Senate and the House and you finally get a bill signed by the President, you're probably years away from putting into place the actual program needed to begin reducing. Whereas if you started using the Clean Air Act today, in fact, obviously if you'd started using it 10 years ago, you would make much quicker progress than you would having to put a whole new system in place. So, you know, there are pros and cons. It's certainly true that if you use the structure of the existing act, it probably is going to be less cost effective than a trading regime. Although I would say there's pretty good authority for using a cap and trade under the existing law, at least for the electricity sector of the economy. But I think from industry's standpoint, they would much prefer to see some of the provisions that are built into the Waxman-Markey bill. They'd obviously like even better provisions.
Sounds like a wonder dog in the background.
Yeah,
there.
That's kind of, I've got to move my dog out of here. She, my kids let her in.
Okay.
I'm at my office. Yeah, so people can argue and debate whether it's a good idea or not to use the Clean Air Act, but the fact of the matter is, from a legal standpoint, it is an effective tool for bringing down those gases.
The New York Times yesterday in an article said Mr. Obama has repeatedly said he much prefers a messy congressional compromise to EPA regulation. Trying to remake much of the economy by regulatory fiat is certain to become entangled in years of litigation. Your comment?
That's certainly true. An attempt to use the Clean Air Act will be met by a ferocious response from particularly the coal industry, but other fossil fuel industries as well. I would have to say, though, with all due respect to the president, I don't think passing a new law is necessarily going to ensure that there isn't going to be litigation over that. Anytime you pass a new complicated law, the Waxman bill is over 200 pages long, you're asking for lawyers to jump all over it and start arguing about how to interpret this word or that word, or does this provision mesh with that provision, and did EPA interpret it the way it was really intended, or did they go beyond that? It's probably true, however, that a bill that got widespread support from the business community is going to have a much better chance of being implemented with the least amount of litigation than if you tried to force reductions through the existing Clean Air Act. So, as I said, there are pros and cons to different approaches. The one thing, though, that really has to come through in this discussion is that we're up against the law of physics here. We're not talking about the kind of environmental problem we've dealt with in the past, where we could take more time to reduce the pollution, try to recover or recoup as we went along. The climate science is basically telling us, as we start moving higher on the temperature spectrum, there's no going back. These climate changes are, for all practical purposes, irreversible. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration recently issued a report.
Let's get into that, Pat Parento, in just a moment. I want to go to the phone. I'm Carl Ettenayer. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Equal Time. Our guest is Pat Parento, professor at Vermont Law School, and we're going to go to Equal Time's Tuesday host, Travin in Middlesex. Hello, Travin.
Well, greetings. I'm really thrilled you're having this conversation. Wanted Pat, you started to distinguish between what's politically possible versus what climate science dictates as necessary in order to forestall a really catastrophic and, I suppose, irreversible climate changes. And with regard to that, Obama's pledge to reduce emissions by, 17% from 2005 levels. If I understand that, that's actually, the goal is less than the baseline established in Kyoto, where the European Union countries said they would limit reduction from 1990 levels. If that pledge was actually carried out, if the Senate was actually to pass the House bill, would we meet what is scientifically necessary, or would it just be a political step forward?
Good question. Thanks, Travin.
That's a very good question, Travis. Thank you. No is the answer. We won't meet what the science is telling us we need. And by science, I'm basically talking about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. That's still regarded as the premier group of global climate scientists in the world. You can find scientists at either end of the spectrum, those that say it's that the IPCC's projections are understatements and that what we really need to do is much greater than that. For example, James Hansen, the head of the Goddard Space Institute, has said we've got to get to the level of 350 parts per million, whereas the IPCC's latest report says it could be 450 parts per million. So you're going to get, even within the scientific community, you're going to get some debate about really how far we have to go to reduce emissions, but clearly the bulk of the scientists are saying we've got to do more than the pledge that the president has made, and we've got to do it faster. A lot of the focus is on 2050 as the target for bringing down our reductions to the level of perhaps 80% or 83% from the 2005 level. That's what the Waxman-Markey bill is talking about. But frankly, The science is increasingly saying we don't have that kind of time to really peak greenhouse gas emissions and bring them down very rapidly, ending perhaps in 2050 with a carbon, essentially a carbon neutral footprint. But it's the early reductions that are the key reductions. And your question about it, would passing this bill in the Congress, even the 17%, do the job? The answer, no. Is it just a political statement? No, it is more than that. You know, if it were followed up with legislation increasing the rate and the amount of reductions that's more in line with what the science is saying, then that would obviously be putting us on the right track and keeping us moving. If, on the other hand, what we got was a bill out of Congress that basically said, well, that's it for now. We're not going to worry about accelerating those reductions, then I have to say, based upon all the reading that I've done from the scientific literature, we're just going to suffer some really, really bad consequences. And by that I mean serious flooding and drought and spread of diseases and pests, heat waves, increased storm and flooding events. You know, those things are coming now. They're measurable, and they're going to get worse. And the only question that we really have as a society is how much worse are we going to allow things to become? That's the only question we've got.
We're going to be talking about that question and others related to the climate change negotiations in Copenhagen right after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm your Monday host, Carl Ettenayer. Check out our website, equaltimeradio.com, to find out more about the show and to download the previous shows. Pat Parento is our guest, Vermont Law School professor. We're talking about the climate change talks in Copenhagen right now. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255 for a toll-free call. Now, Pat Parento, there is an article by Mike Tidwell in the Washington Post earlier this month saying, to really save the planet, stop going green. He begins, as President Obama heads to Copenhagen next week, this is when thought he was going earlier in the talks, there's one simple step Americans back home can take to help out. Stop going green. Just stop it. No more compact fluorescent light bulbs. No more green wedding planning. December should be National Green Free Month. And he says, we should follow the example of Americans during past moral crises and work towards large-scale change instead of doing these individual changes. And really, he's focusing on picking up the phone, calling your senators, and saying, get a good climate change bill through Congress. But if we take that question a bit further, if people listening right now want to influence the U.S. negotiating position in Copenhagen, is there any meaningful way to do that at this point?
Well, we know where the problems are in getting legislation passed in the Congress. They're largely in the states with coal reserves. You know, we have the best delegation in Congress right now for climate change. You couldn't ask for three better representatives. Bernie Sanders is on both of the key committees. Peter Welch in the House was a big supporter of the Waxman bill, and Senator Leahy's been a constant supporter of strong climate legislation. So, you know, all we can do with our delegation is to say thanks and keep up the good work and keep twisting arms of your colleagues. But, you know, reaching out to our friends and families and associates in those key swing states where you have, there's an identified list of what are called fence sitters in the Senate, many of which are Democrats, like Max Baucus and Blanche Lincoln and people in Indiana and Illinois, West Virginia. These are states where the initial cost of reducing greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide, and shifting away from coal and away from other fossil fuels is going to be difficult. There's no getting around it. Obviously, if this were an easy thing to fix, we'd have fixed it by now. So it's by no means going to be easy.
Well, that's for getting something through the Senate. How about in terms of, do our senators, does our representative have any influence over the negotiating stance in Copenhagen, or should we be going directly to the head of the EPA, Lisa Jackson, or to the White House?
Oh, you mean trying to influence Copenhagen itself?
That's right.
I don't see how we influence that. I mean, what the heads of state that are arriving there want to see is the political establishment of the United States behind the president. That they want to see more evidence that he's not just out there making promises he can't keep. You know, Obama still has tremendous respect and affection, really, around the world. So it's not, we're no longer in a position of having a leader that nobody respects. We're way beyond that. Now we have the situation where even with the best leader we could have, does he have the support he needs?
Hmm.
So that gets back to really being able to deliver the votes in the Senate. That's the key battleground. So I think the more that we can do to influence other senators to come forward, get off the fence, get behind the bill, that's really what's needed.
Talk about the difference between the conservative parties in the European Union and their approach to climate change and the Republicans in the United States.
Yeah, that's a very interesting dichotomy, if you will, between our political culture and that of the European countries. For one thing, over time, there seems to have been a much easier chance to get agreement between the government and the business leaders in European countries than here in the United States. Much less adversary relationship, confrontation, hostility, much less litigation over environmental regulations, far more agreement on things like take-back legislation, using environmental taxes and environmental fees, which is, of course, a huge no-no to even talk about that in this country, but that's standard practice in most European countries. And, you know, I don't pretend to know, I'm not a political scientist, I don't totally understand why it is that the relationship between our conservative politicians in this country is so different than the way the conservative politicians and business leaders in Europe operate. They seem to see that these environmental issues, once the science has coalesced around the threat being real and not, you know, fanciful, the ability to come together and reach agreement on how to address the problem seems to be something you can get done in the European Union. I mean, the European Union, if you look at it, has some similarities to the United States. You have countries with different economic situations, very different cultural approaches to things, a history of, you know, some difficult history of wars and strife, and yet that federation, if you will, can sit down and hammer out a constitution, hammer out laws. They even have their own court system to resolve disputes among themselves. Whereas we're drifting further apart here in the United States. The divide, the ideological divide between our major parties, Republican and Democrat, I have to say it's the greatest it's been in my 30-plus years of doing environmental policy.
It's
a real problem.
Matthew Iglesias blogs for the Center for American Progress, and he took a trip with a number of other journalists to Europe in September and noted again and again in the United Kingdom, in Denmark, in Germany, how the conservative parties there just accepted what climate scientists were saying, accepted that the scientists knew what they were talking about, and then rolled up their sleeves to do the work of figuring out how to address the problem. And in one post, he addressed the conservative party in the UK versus the Republican in the U.S. and says, after all, it's not just that the Conservatives' climate and energy issues webpage looks very different from the Republican one. The Republicans don't even have one at all.
Wow. Sad comment. And, I don't know what's going to get us over this. You have to hope. You have to hope here's a positive sign, okay? So Lindsey Graham, one of the staunchest conservative Republicans from South Carolina in the country, has stepped forward to and has taken some huge hits from his own party, and certainly from the right wing of his party, for saying to John Kerry, I will link arms with you and push through a climate bill if you give me some things that I want. He's a big supporter of nuclear power, and he wants to see more offshore oil and gas development. He wants to have more, you know, domestic oil sources than having to rely on imports. Those are hard things for environmentalists to swallow. Mm-hmm. But John Kerry said, yes, okay, if that's the price for getting the support of one of the leading people in the Republican Party, and the president said the same thing. We know that our two Republican senators from Maine, Susan Collins, and her colleague up there,
Olympia Snowe,
we know that they're willing, they're on the fence a bit, but they're probably going to vote for it. But then you have to search real hard. McCain was a supporter of climate legislation for a while, but has been raising questions about the current approach, but ultimately I think he'll come over. So the only thing we can hope for is that a combination of Democrats and probably a small number, but critical number of Republicans will come over and vote for a climate bill. That's the hope.
We're talking with Pat Parento. I'm Carl Ettner. This is Equal Time on WDEV. We'll be going to the phones in just a minute. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettner. We have time to go very quickly to the phone. Roger in Worcester, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for letting me on. I just wanted to mention that I think studying global warming since about 1986 and seeing the effects of it, you know, through climate, it's not going to be until the American conservative South really starts to get affected. And who's getting affected? It's mostly the North, and that's usually in areas where you might say the population is a little more centrist, even liberal. And the areas that are getting affected right now are like New England, the most extreme precipitation events. We're seeing, you know, sort of variations and kind of weirding going on in our weather. That would also include Alaska, but of course that doesn't work there politically. But at the same time, I think it's going to be the American South. The climate change is also a billboard. The weather is going to be the billboard, and that's what's going to speak to people. And until that happens, I'm afraid people are just going to not really care. And unfortunately, I think a political conservative is an oxymoron. There's nothing conservative about spewing atmospheric CO2 into the atmosphere to you know, ruin your climate.
Interesting.
That is not a conservative thing at all.
Interesting comment there, Roger.
Well,
thanks so much for your call. We're about out of time. Pat Parento, about 20 seconds to respond to that.
I think it was an excellent point. Of course, in Florida, they're beginning to see the effects of climate change very dramatically, and sea level rise, coastal erosion, saltwater intrusion. But it's true that the Deep South has yet to really embrace, connect the dots, if you will. You know, the storms that are coming across the Gulf of Mexico are getting more intense. Atlanta's experiencing record droughts and record floods back-to-back. You know, the evidence is mounting, and I don't know how much it's going to take. What we need, I guess, is sort of a Pearl Harbor moment, if you will, across the United States, that we really got to get serious.
Pat Parento, Vermont Law School professor, thanks for your time.
You betcha. My pleasure.
Keep tuned to WDEV for the latest news on Copenhagen, especially Democracy Now!, 5:30 each day with live coverage from the Bella Center. Thanks for the calls from Travin and Roger. I'm Carl Ettner. That's it for Monday's Equal Time. I'll be back next Monday. And Artie Levine produced the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Peak Oil Check-In. Exploring the end of the age of oil.
Mike Tidwell in the Washington Post urged readers earlier this month to stop being green for the month of December, while the U.S. Senate struggles to pass climate change legislation and world leaders meet in Copenhagen to hammer out a new climate change treaty. He has a point. Tidwell says, quote, "No more compact fluorescent light bulbs, no more green wedding planning, no more organic toothpicks for holiday hors d'oeuvres," unquote. He urges us to, quote, "follow the example of Americans during past moral crises and work toward large-scale change. Don't take a day to caulk your windows. Instead, pick up a phone, open a laptop, or travel to a U.S. Senate office near you and turn the tables. What are the 10 green statutes you're working on to save the planet, Senator? Unquote. Well, it's common to say this. It's also true, apparently. What's at stake is nothing less than the future of our civilization. The 8 years since 2001 have been among the 10 hottest ever recorded. ICE provides a good record of trends in the climate, and it doesn't tell a pretty story. Arctic sea ice is shrinking rapidly, with 2009 levels down more than 25% below the average of the first two decades of measurements. The area covered by glaciers in the world has dropped by 50% since the end of the 19th century. Reduction in snowpack and glaciers are already causing droughts and crop failures in one of North America's most productive agricultural areas, the Central Valley of California. Rising global temperatures risk hitting tipping points that trigger runaway climate change that no international agreement could stop. A tipping point is an occurrence that drives further global warming regardless of human influence. The melting Arctic sea ice, for example, means less sunlight is reflected and more heat is absorbed during the summer, further melting sea ice. Widespread melting of the Arctic permafrost can release large amounts of methane, which is far more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Passing a significant climate change tipping point would mean that humanity no longer controls its climate destiny, no matter how much we spend and how much political will we muster. Wait a minute, you might be asking. Isn't this the peak oil check-in? What's the connection between peak oil and climate change? I'd like to tell you not to worry. It's true that a growing number of people believe that there's much less recoverable oil in the ground than has been assumed in the models of the Nobel Prize-winning International Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. So total oil-related carbon dioxide emissions are likely to be less than the IPCC projects, even in their worst-case scenario. However, Arctic sea ice is also melting faster than the IPCC projected in their earlier models. They used to talk about the Arctic summer being ice-free by the end of the century. Now it could be in a decade or two. Coal is the biggest potential driver of human-caused climate change. Some peak oil experts, like Richard Heidenberg, are arguing that, as with oil, there's a lot less recoverable coal in the ground than many people believe. Still, peak coal may be decades out, and climate scientists like James Hansen of NASA say that the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere needs to be dropped from where it is now down to 350 parts per million. Use of coal must be phased out, not increased or even kept steady, to prevent runaway climate change. So there's no solace from peak oil or peak coal, no direct potential for them to kick in and help us hit emission targets. Unless oil shortages, in particular, help keep the world in recession. There's a glut of oil in the world right now, but that's not expected to last. The World Bank and the International Energy Agency expect that the world will not be able to meet all demand for oil without skyrocketing prices just around the corner in 2012 or so. Jumps in oil prices could put the economy into recession, just as they did last year. I don't know whether a prolonged recession would result in enough drop in CO2 emissions to start reducing what's in the atmosphere, but it's not really a good policy tool. Which would you prefer? Reducing emissions through a longer recession and unemployment? Or to invest now in creating green jobs that reduce our dependence on coal and oil? It's not a bad idea, as Tidwell says, to hang up your caulking gun for the month of December, pick up the phone, and ask your senators to pass a good climate change bill. And ask the White House to negotiate a strong climate change treaty in Denmark. I'm Carl Ettenayer, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.